Today I want to talk about vocabulary learning, and the importance of prediction in how we use language, how we learn languages, how AI works, and so forth. A quick note, following up on my video about my Arabic learning experience, some people thought that I had given up on Arabic or was finding it too difficult. That's not the case. I am continuing with my Levantine Arabic studies. And before I move on to Hindi, I will do a full interview with Samer where we will just have a conversation, and you'll see that I am making progress, despite the difficulties that I pointed to in my previous video. So, vocabulary. I said when I first founded Link, or co-founded, vocabulary is the best measure of where you are in a language. Vocabulary is power. If you don't have the words, you can't understand concepts. Words are absolutely essential to progress in a language. And I thought of this in connection with prediction because I was listening to a presentation here in Palm Springs. There's a group called the World Affairs Council or something. People of my age get together and listen to people talk about different things related to world events. We had a speaker who happened to be a Canadian, Jim Boutillier from Victoria, and who gave a wonderful presentation on the history of Chinese-Russian relations. What struck me was, first of all, how masterful his control of the subject, his control of the language was, and the way in which he would lead his audience in a certain direction, and then he would actually say something that went counter to our expectations. And this either elicited a laugh from people, or were some of the parts of his presentation that were the most memorable. And I just thought about this, how we tend to predict, we tend to expect certain things, and when what we hear or what we read is different from our expectations, it makes an impression on us. And that's very much part of the study, the research that's now going on using, ultrasound mapping of the brain, this N400 response when something happens that's contrary to our expectations. And that's an important part of learning, which takes me then to how do we acquire words? And it starts, of course, in our native language at school. And there are a number of myths. One of these myths is that the reason why some children read better than others is because they arrive with a larger vocabulary. And so those parents that speak to their kids and use a lot of words, those kids have heard a lot of words, and therefore they will read better than their, you know, peers who've had a less word-rich environment at home. And I have said this before because I've read, you know, studies that seem to imply this. However, it's obviously not the case because, first of all, we have what's known as the immigrant paradox. So it turns out that first-generation immigrants who came to the United States, Canada, whichever immigrant-receiving country, and their children were 5, 6, 8, 10, or even if they were born there but whose parents didn't speak to them in, say, English, if it's North America, those kids end up reading better than the native-born kids. And this is true not just for Asians, where it's particularly marked, but it's also true for immigrants from Latin America. And of course, it has to do with other factors. The support that kids have at home, the interest in learning, resources perhaps that are put into helping the child. In other words, a whole bunch of factors. But the idea that those kids who have heard a lot of words will necessarily be better at reading turns out not to be the case. It's also disproved because there are many examples of children in the same family. One child reads much better than the other. So the family sort of environment for the child is not the deciding factor on how well people will read at school. Another myth you hear is that children are corrected when they use the language incorrectly. But this is also not the case. So the interesting thing is four-year-olds will tend to what's called over-regularize the past tense in English, and presumably in other languages. In other words, they will say ated instead of ate, applying the rule that their brain has already discovered as a pattern. They'll apply that where it doesn't work. And so four-year-olds will over-regularize the past tense, whereas six-year-olds, even though they're exposed to lots of examples of irregular forms and regular forms, they self-correct. So it's not because the children are corrected, nor even because they're exposed to many examples of either the, you know, regular past tense or the irregular past tense. Just because of the vast quantity of language content that they are exposed to, they will, through massive exposure, develop the correct usage, if in fact that's the usage that they're exposed to. If they live in an environment where people say, I would have went instead of I would have gone, then that's what will become the pattern for them. In either case, it's this sort of probability of what's the correct answer and then hearing it often enough that enables the kids to speak correctly, not being corrected. So that's also an important concept as we go forward in how we learn words. Word learning is in fact a probabilistic, I have trouble with that word, probabilistic, error-driven process. This also runs counter to another myth or popular theory, which is Chomsky's universal grammar theory, which postulates that a speaker of a language intrinsically, innately knows what is correct in a language. And there's all kinds of reasons why this is not so, because many of the things that are correct in language A are not correct in language B, and quite a wide variety of usage patterns are very different in different languages. So here again, it's more a matter of this error-driven probabilistic pattern that determines how kids learn languages, not some innate, you know, language instinct. In fact, this brain mapping has even shown that the white matter in the brain adapts differently for different languages. So that it's not that the brain determines a sort of a language instinct. It's more that the language environment influences the brain. So here again, some of these sort of accepted ideas, sometimes based more on ideology than science, confuse us when we think about how we acquire language. We acquire language through exposure and through the ability of the brain to develop patterns of what is normal usage. So this pattern of massive amounts of exposure, developing sort of a memory, a sense of what is the language, actually enables the brain to predict what's going to happen. And in some cases, of course, what we expect is not what happens. And again, research shows that this N400, or when something contrary to our expectations, in other words, a different word than we expected or a grammatical structure that we didn't expect it, when we get a negative response, that spikes something in our brain, this N400 response, and that's an important part of our learning. So it's this error-driven function in the brain that helps us learn things. And that apparently is very similar, this idea of using a vast memory of words to predict what's going to come is how AI works. And the more AI progresses, the closer it comes to how the brain works. So given that our learning of words is based on a massive sort of exposure to stimulus, then how much time should we invest in word mapping or other instructional techniques to try to nail down individual words when we're learning them, as opposed to how much time we want to spend giving ourselves as much exposure as possible? I have noticed, for example, in my Arabic, that as difficult as I find the Arabic writing system to be, it is far more difficult for me to read a word written in the Arabic alphabet which is not an Arabic word. So it might be a name from a foreign language or something of a foreign word. That's much more difficult for me than to read an Arabic word, because at some level, subconsciously, unbeknownst to me, my brain has started to form some patterns around what is an Arabic word. And ultimately, for me in Arabic, I have a lot of trouble reading a word that I don't already know. But even in reading words that I haven't seen before, somewhere in the brain, there is a sense of what is a normal Arabic pattern and what is not at all an Arabic word. I would imagine that for people learning English, it's much the same. So many words in English are not spelled the way they are pronounced. So if you don't know the word, it's very difficult to read it out. I think increasingly, as we become better and better at reading, we predict what that pronunciation should be based on some pattern that we have internalized, or we know the word. So it helps to know the word. It helps to have seen the word before. Frequency of exposure is a big part of learning words. But it turns out, according to research, that frequency of exposure is more important for high frequency words and especially for nouns. And when it comes to lower frequency words or verbs, it's more important to encounter the word in a variety, in as many different contexts as possible, because that word is connected with other words, both in terms of its syntax or its function, grammatical function in the sentence, and in terms of which words are normally used with which other words. And all of that is part of that, developing that ability to predict what's coming, to predict what a word means that you haven't seen before, which is all an important part of increasing our vocabulary. And I would add that the low frequency words are extremely important, because getting back to my original example, this presenter, Mr. Beautillier, has a wonderful vocabulary which enables him to speak in a rich way about a complex problem. And if you don't have that vocabulary, you can't understand these concepts, and certainly you can't express yourself on these concepts. So what are we to do in order to acquire the vocabulary that we need? Initially, a rich passive vocabulary, and then ultimately an active vocabulary. So first of all, as I've said many times, in language learning, the key elements are your attitude, your motivation, and the time you have available with or spend with the language. So therefore, it's important to do things that we enjoy doing. Because you never know in a particular sort of learning activity how much of that is actual learning, how much is going to stick. We don't know. So better to do something I enjoy doing where I'm likely to continue to do it. The second issue is time is the major constraint. So it's important to try to do those things that we are convinced, or which objectively we can show, are most effective. So is it more effective to review a bunch of words in isolation, or is it more effective to spend that time reading and listening or in conversation? We have to make these choices. So obviously, if we have 8 hours a day to spend on learning a language, as I did when I was learning Mandarin, then I can do a variety of different things. If I have 1 hour or 2 hours a day, then I have to really make sure that I'm spending my time as effectively as possible. And in that regard, my view is that studying words in isolation, doing flashcards, even investing a lot of time in any activity to try to sort of activate vocabulary that you've just learned so that you'll actually be able to use it right away, or doing quizzes or closed tests or any of this stuff, is less effective than expanding my basic passive vocabulary and eventually starting to speak. And when we speak, much as is the case in the AI model, we have this vast memory of words, and we reach into that memory and we try things. There's sort of an element of prediction. We think that this word is going to work. We try it out. It either works or it doesn't work. If it works, that reinforces our confidence in using that word. We will use it again, or a given structure. If it doesn't work, that also gives us an important message. It's a sort of error-driven, probabilistic learning process of the language. So I prefer to engage in conversations on meaningful subjects of interest to me, where I can attempt to pull out words that I have in my memory. And in most cases, I can't pull them out and I remember the word after our conversation. But at least it's a meaningful conversation, and I enjoy doing that. Whereas trying to scratch my head to remember the meaning of a word from a list or from a quiz or from a flashcard is just not something that I enjoy doing. The only time I use flashcards is immediately after having encountered the word in a context, because I think that additional amount of reminding is effective, and only if it's a small number. So if I'm in sentence mode on Link and I have three words in that sentence, I might review three words. I'm not going to review 50 or 100 words, because pretty soon I'm spending all my time doing something which I don't enjoy doing. And also another issue, of course, is this issue of repetition versus novelty. So as I pointed out many times, as Manfred Spitzer pointed out, the brain needs repetition, but the brain likes novelty. The brain likes relevance, likes important things, important to the brain. So studying things of interest is important to the brain. But when I start out in a language, because I have, you know, so few known words, like maybe I'm 50, 60% unknown words, then I'm quite willing to listen over and over again in order to try to get a toehold. And after listening, then to read those words and to try to get a sense of what's there. But as my percentage of unknown words declines, if there's only 10 or 15% unknown words, then I cannot listen over and over again, because it's boring for the brain. The brain's not interested. It's got most of it. It's not new to the brain. And the brain will find those terms, those words and structures in other content that's more interesting to the brain. I also find that wherever I can vary not only the type of content I listen to, but even the way I expose myself to it, like listening or reading online, or as in the case of these texts that I mentioned the other day that I'm finding very, very interesting, is to be able to read Arabic on paper. I also have those texts in audio form. I also have them imported into Link so I can look up words that it's not obvious from here what those words mean. But by sort of attacking these texts from a variety of different ways, I'm enriching my experience. I'm enjoying doing it. But the underlying principle is that exposure to vocabulary in a variety of contexts is going to be, I'm quite convinced, more effective, a more effective use of my time, even in terms of understanding the different forms of the words and their implication from a grammatical point of view. My exposure to them in a variety of contexts is going to be better than trying to read the same grammar rules over and over again, study the same flashcards over and over again, because I'm doing what the kids were doing, and that is, I predict what's going to be there, I predict what the word might mean, it means something else. All of this sort of error-driven, probabilistic learning process, although I, as an adult, have advantages over the kids, I have a larger vocabulary in my own language, I know a lot more, I have some domain knowledge, but nevertheless, that basic process, in my belief, is the same. So, I touched on a variety of things. I have spoken on vocabulary before. I leave you with a couple of videos, and I hope I didn't stray too far from things that I do know something about into areas that I don't know so much about. Thanks for listening.